Today on the show, a major health insurance deal. Maybe you get used to hearing those words. And Greece, is it a yes or a no? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the show. It may be a holiday, but that doesn't mean we let our weekly wrappers off the hook. Here today to talk about the big news of the week, Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rampell of the Washington Post. Hey there. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Molly.
Hey, Molly.
So I want to start by talking about college tuition and the industry of education. The state of Washington this week announced major tuition cuts, which is maybe the first time we've ever seen that in the country. Also, new rules for for-profit colleges have gone into effect. Sudeep, what do you think that this says about the idea of education as a business?
We're certainly learning a lot about what the flaws are for having higher education as a for-profit industry. Some of the for-profit schools actually do provide a useful service, so we have to keep that in mind. But so many of them have been built on the easy ride of student debt, have been able to take advantage of young people who think this is an easy way to get in and get skills, when in reality, this whole model of education that we have, higher education, needs to be disrupted. And a lot of higher education operates like the internet was just created yesterday. And we're going to have to see us move well beyond that and adopt new technologies to adapt to the kind of economy we have today.
And Catherine, I feel like we've seen so many attempts to disrupt education, and it's such an entrenched institution. Do you think that's even possible?
We have seen some major developments in terms of MOOCs, you know, the massive open online courses. I think that's what it stands for. I think the real challenge is figuring out quality because, you know, online classes have been around for quite a while. And in the eyes of many employers, if there's no other objective measure you want to look at, they're not worth very much a lot of the time. So we may see disruption, but without some better information about whether the skills that students are learning through these new business models are actually worth anything, you know, it's very hard to say.
Mm-hmm. The outcome question becomes huge. Mm-hmm. Moving on to other big news of the week, Whole Foods yesterday, its co-CEOs actually apologized for ripping off customers, mislabeling certain packages, in some cases underpricing groceries, but in most cases overcharging, as you might imagine. But Catherine, I feel like things like slack fill are increasingly common across the industry. I mean, how will this affect sort of the industry overall? Whole Foods is going to bring in third-party auditors now. Is this a big deal?
It seems like a big deal if you're a consumer. I mean, I think with Whole Foods, it already has a reputation for being very expensive. You know, Whole Paycheck is the nickname for the store. So I think that a lot of people might become even more cynical about that brand in particular. But probably this mislabeling issue is not exclusive to that particular brand. And I do wonder if consumers will start paying much more attention to the weights and labels on their packaged goods.
There's always going to be, Sudeep, right? That person in line with the scale.
There is. But when I saw this news, I just couldn't believe it. Whole Foods, for once, apologized for their prices.
Yeah.
At least we can take that as some kind of development. Look, anybody who shops at Whole Foods knows they're not going to the dollar store. So you know what you're getting. But it is kind of amazing that for all the technological advancement we've had in pricing, in commerce, in grocery store procurement, that we still have something like this going on. And given all of the possibilities of grocery delivery and what we're seeing there, this is going to have to develop sooner so that people don't get unwittingly ripped off at the grocery store.
Yeah, but I personally want to play that GIF of them apologizing over and over and over, basically every time I check out.
Absolutely.
And then also in the news this week, you saw this report about Uber reportedly operating at a $500 million loss. We don't know that much about those numbers, but Catherine, what did this report suggest to you?
It suggests that Uber is able to continue its massive efforts to hire tons and tons of lobbyists and, you know, blanket the world in a pro-Uber campaign, largely because they're getting a lot of funding, you know, not because they're making a lot of money at this point, it seems. Mm-hmm. So they can afford, you know, makes sense for them to continue losing money for a little while if it gains them market share.
Yeah, Sudeep, how is this, you know, if indeed these numbers are accurate currently, how is this different from somebody like Amazon, who arguably doesn't turn a profit, reinvests every penny?
Well, they're trying to do the Amazon play here of become really big, become really powerful, and look for the profits down the line. So it's not that surprising. They're obviously swimming in VC money, and they're hoping to build something that can survive once the music stops. We all know that the music is going to stop, and they are obviously the big player in this space. So they perhaps will have the best shot, even if they are operating at a loss.
All right. Uber is the next Amazon. You heard it here first. Thanks, guys. Have a great holiday weekend.
Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Molly.
Wall Street was closed today, but the drama in the Chinese market didn't take a vacation. We'll have more when we do the numbers. Today, the third biggest health insurance company in America announced it would buy the fourth biggest. Aetna will buy Humana for $37 billion if the deal is completed next year. At the moment, it would be the biggest deal ever done in the health insurance industry, but it might not have that title for long. What's going on here? Changing health economics, Obamacare? Yeah, pretty much all of that. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
If health insurance were a playground, you'd see fewer individual kids running around because they're all teaming up. Why? Size matters because insurers negotiate what they pay to doctors and hospitals, and they're merging and getting bigger too. Analyst Anna Gupte is with the investment bank Leerink Partners.
In a local market, it's a matter of who has the greater market power. So Humana combined with Aetna has a lot more market power in any market with a hospital or a physician group.
Insurance firms have to be big and nimble. Under the Affordable Care Act, Gupte says overhead and profitability are capped. And these days, competition for insurers to get corporate customers is more fierce than ever, says J.B. Silvers. He's a former insurance exec who now teaches business at Case Western Reserve.
The old days where you had a broker who was cozy with a particular employer and could direct the traffic, that kind of a business-to-business market has eroded.
Now, if you watch the insurance playground closely, you see many running in one direction, toward old people. The part of the Medicare market run by private insurers is growing as more boomers age into it, and Humana is big in that space. So, if mergers like this make sense for insurers, as they do for the doctors and the hospitals, what about patients? Well, it may not be so great, says Limor Daphne. She's a health economist at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
Consolidation in both sectors has led to increases in provider prices and health insurance premiums.
She says antitrust authorities need to ask some tough questions before this goes through. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Earlier this week, a changing of the guard at one of America's most successful corporations and brands, Nike. 77-year-old Phil Knight is stepping down as chairman of the company, and he wants his longtime right-hand man, current Nike CEO Mark Parker, to take over. You could argue it's a good time to step aside. Nike's last earning report had its revenue topping $30 billion. So can Knight's successors keep the good times rolling? From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Over half a century, Nike has outrun many of its rivals, formerly globe-dominating sportswear companies like Adidas. Paul Swangard at the University of Oregon says Phil Knight has baked his personal business ethos into the company he's passing on.
The idea of always pursuing innovation and always pursuing that extra edge that would provide an athlete the ability to perform at his or her best.
Of course, Nike's sophisticated global supply chain helps, with high-priced designers and marketing types here and low-cost contract shoemaking workers overseas. Sports business professor Patrick Risch at Washington University says it's not innovation so much as marketing their athletes that's pushed Nike to the front of the pack. As in Spike Lee talking to Michael Jordan.
Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious dunks?
No, Mars.
Is it the hair?
Look at the Michael Jordan and the Tiger Woods effects. Makes it very difficult for other competitors. They have that first mover advantage.
Though, says women's marketing expert Mary Lou Quinlan, Nike's competitors are being smart, too.
Under Armour is the one that I'd be worried about if I were Nike, because they seem to have struck that strong woman place with their unique choice of celebrities. It's like Misty Copeland, you know, the new principal dancer of the American Ballet Theater.
But Quinlan says Nike's been smart marketing to women, too.
Even if we are wearing it to run to the office, you know, yoga pants are pants. And sneakers are fashion.
Paul Swangard at the University of Oregon says Phil Knight was merely good as a runner in college, but he's been a top-notch competitor in business. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Big moment coming in Greece this weekend, the latest of many very big moments, I know, but this one could actually finally decide how the long-running saga of the Greek debt crisis will end. On Sunday, there's a nationwide referendum. Greeks will vote on whether the country should accept the latest deal proposed by its creditors. Even more austerity and reform in return for more cash to pay its debts. The government wants the country to vote no, which could mean exiting the euro. Opinion polls say it's too close to call, and protests are building on both sides as the vote gets closer. From the European desk, Stephen Beard reports.
Yes or no, that is the question. But what is the actual question in Sunday's Greek referendum? Are you ready for this? Here we go.
Should the plan of agreement be accepted, which was submitted by the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund in the Eurogroup of the 25th of June and comprises of two parts which constitute their unified proposal? Yes or no?
And to add to the complexity, the plan of agreement that the referendum is supposed to accept or reject has already been withdrawn. Nevertheless, Greece is dividing into two clearly defined camps, yes and no, for and against. Greece, Europe and democracy, chant these protesters. They believe their country, its membership in the European Union, and even its democracy will be at risk unless they vote yes.
My name is Efrosini Pavlakoudi, and I'm going to vote on the Greek referendum in favour of yes.
Telecom engineer Efrosini Pavlakoudi says a no vote would cut off any chance of further help from the creditors and finish off the country's tottering banks.
If we vote no, we have the collapse of the banking system in Greece. It's a matter of life or death. This is really what is happening at the moment.
And she believes that Greece could be forced out of the euro by its 18 eurozone partners.
If we vote no, we have 18 countries suggesting that we start the process of actually kicking you out from the EU. The effect of a no vote would be, for me, disastrous.
But the word no, ochi, has a special resonance in Greece.
Ochi! Ochi! Ochi!
Protesters chanted in central Athens. The word carries powerful overtones of national pride and defiance. There's even an Ochi Day, commemorating the resounding answer that Greece gave to overtures from the Italian dictator Mussolini during the Second World War. As Sunday's referendum looms, the word no has taken on a fresh appeal.
I'm Elena Christidi. I'm a psychologist, and I'm going to vote no.
Christidi believes that a no vote will strengthen the government's hand in negotiations with the creditors and so help keep the country in the euro. And it will defiantly, proudly proclaim that Greece rejects austerity and the misery it's caused.
We cannot just forget our values and the human factor. We cannot just continue cutting our payments, thinking only with numbers.
But in the end, it's numbers that will determine Greece's fate. Its shuttered banks are reported to be down to their last half a billion euros. If there's a yes vote on Sunday, they could get the cash injection they need. If it's a no, Greece may be forced to launch its own currency and face a very perilous future. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
People will come up to you and they'll tell you their Alamo story. Whatever that is, I came with my grandmother. My grandfather came and showed me around the Alamo. We all have our own concept of the Alamo.
A national landmark under new leadership. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed in the U.S. in observance of the 4th of July holiday, but for the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P slumped 1.2%, and the NASDAQ dropped 1.4%. Overseas, stock markets were mostly down today, capping off a week of jitters because of Greece. As we told you earlier in the program, a weekend referendum there will decide what happens next to the country and its future in the Eurozone. In Asia, China's Shanghai Composite Index retreated nearly 6% today. That index has plunged almost 30% since mid-June. Regulators in China have announced an investigation into market manipulation there. And in Europe, Britain's FTSE dropped 0.7%, France's CAC 40 gave back more than 0.5%, and Germany's DAX lost more than 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Dalai Lama celebrates his 80th birthday. On July 6, 1933, the first Major League Baseball All-Star Game was played in Chicago. And for your stadium experience, July is National Hot Dog Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
The Federal Communications Commission has now been in the business of enforcing net neutrality for a little less than a month, and it's been pretty busy. The FCC promptly fined AT&T $100 million for throttling some users' unlimited data access. Sprint got a little scared and said that it would stop doing the same thing now that the new rules were in effect. One formal net neutrality complaint has already been filed as businesses and the government try to figure out what the internet service game looks like now. I asked the chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, whether that government agency suddenly has a lot more going on.
Well, you're right, Molly. And it is the big item. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the internet is redefining all of our lives. Is an incredibly personal experience for all of us. And so when you put rules in place that say that there'll be no blocking, there'll be no throttling, and there'll be no paying for some kind of special priority treatment, we've established, you know, what are the rules for the road. We have also put in place a set of general conduct rules, which I call the equivalent of having a referee on the field. We're not going to tell the players how to play the game. We're not going to get in there and micromanage like old-time regulation used to. But we're going to be on the field ready to throw a flag if there's a foul. And that's a new concept in regulation.
It seems like the rules are pretty clear, whether you agree with them or not. But there is one sort of outstanding question, and that's this idea of zero rating. Could you describe that for our listeners?
Well, zero rating is the concept that there are some services for which there shouldn't be a charge. If zero rating ends up being something that is anti-openness or anti-consumer in this specific case, then we want to be able to step in and say, no, that's not right. But we're not going to sit here and prejudge on a blanket basis.
Will you proactively look at, for example, like T-Mobile's free music service where you can stream from Spotify or iHeartRadio or a number of streaming music services without counting against your data cap? That's a plus for consumers, but it would also seem to violate the spirit of net neutrality pretty clearly. You don't think of zero rating as a decent-sized loophole?
No, I think that the challenge with zero rating is that it is on a broad basis. It ranges from, well, I could favor my product by charging zero, to the other end that says, gee, I may want to zero rate, a heart monitoring service for somebody who's just come out of the hospital after having a heart transplant. I mean, it's kind of there's a range in here. So the looking at things on a case-by-case basis and saying, okay, does that smell right, is a very integral aspect of how our rules operate. And I got to tell you that, you know, what we have seen thus far in terms of how ISPs, Internet Service Providers, have been acting as they have entered into new interconnection agreements has convinced us that it makes sense to have somebody watching over their shoulder and ready to jump in if necessary. And
that's kind of dishy. That's a little bit of a dishy statement.
Well,
they
I don't
need
mean
watching
to be,
is what you're saying.
I don't mean to be dishy about the whole thing, Molly. But I mean, I think it. I think that people are behaving differently because of the fact that there's a referee on the field, mm-hmm. and I think that's good.
FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, thank you so much for joining us.
Molly, thank you.
And now, appropriately enough, a story about a fight for independence. There's arguably nothing that represents the independent spirit of Texas more than the Alamo. You know the one. It's most famous for what happened there in 1836 during the Texas Revolution. That's when just a few hundred would-be Texans and their allies temporarily held off a few thousand members of the Mexican army. But more than 175 years later, there's a new struggle for control of the Alamo. Laura Rice explains.
You'd be forgiven if the most you know about the Alamo comes from the 1960 film of the same name starring John Wayne as Davy Crockett.
Well, thanks, friend. If you don't insist on having them to yourself, I'll give you a hand.
Pleasure, friend.
But for many Texans, this place is sacred, as this excerpt from an Alamo audio tour explains.
The stones of the church wall were spotted with blood. The doors were splintered and battered in.
People will come up to you and they'll tell you their Alamo story. Whatever that is, I came with my grandmother. My grandfather came and showed me around the Alamo. We all have our own concept of the Alamo and what it is and what it stands for. Becky Denon is the new director of the Alamo. She got the job in February, just before the state of Texas canceled its contract with the Daughters of the Republic of Texas to manage the Alamo. The DRT, a group of women who can trace their ancestry to early supporters of an independent Texas, had been taking care of the site for about a century. But the state cited numerous problems, including poorly cared for buildings. Number one on the list, poor money management. So the Alamo itself might not be making a lot of money, but as I walk across the street here, it's pretty clear everyone else is. There's a Ripley's, believe it or not, and one of those wax museums, along with about a dozen gift shops selling T-shirts and candy and everything else. Now, the Alamo may be rethinking its neighbors and extending its footprint, but probably the biggest part of Denon's job is to lead an enormous fundraising campaign for the Alamo. Still, she emphasizes there's a more important goal than making money.
This is really about telling the story of the Alamo. Certainly, we want it to operate in the black, but our goal is not revenue.
Denon says there will never be a fee to enter the Alamo itself, but it could cost something to visit a future museum. A museum at the site is a requirement of the recent donation of the largest private collection of Alamo artifacts, gifted to Texas by Phil Collins.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
Yes, that Phil Collins. The British rocker is also a Texas history enthusiast.
Maybe that's a little bit of what sparked it. Maybe that was a great kick in the pants that he gave to all of us to say now's the time to do the right thing for the Alamo.
And that brings us back to the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. Though they've given up their fight to remain the Alamo's caretakers, they're concerned about the idea of charging any visitor fees. And they're not letting the state have the 38,000 documents they've collected over the years related to Alamo and Texas history. Lamont Jefferson is representing the DRT in a lawsuit.
The lawsuit basically says that the daughters own the collection at the library that is on the Alamo complex. The state of Texas has taken the position that the collection belongs to the state of Texas unless the daughters can prove otherwise.
The DRT says it's worried the Alamo will become too commercial. The group's president has said she doesn't want it to become Disneyland. Director Becky Denon says the Alamo won't become Disneyland, but maybe more like another U.S. historical site.
For people who've been to see the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, similar to what they have redone that space.
Though Texas and the Alamo's new leadership envision a new future for the historical site, one thing will never change.
And you will always remember the Alamo.
In San Antonio, I'm Laura Rice for Marketplace.
These final notes before we go, mobile payments with your face. Most people aren't paying for things with their phones just yet, but if you are, you might be just getting used to using your fingerprint to authorize a transaction. Well, MasterCard is blazing right ahead. They're creating an app that will let you pay for items using your face. Well, technically, you pay for items using your MasterCard, obviously. But to authorize that mobile payment, you look at your phone's selfie cam and blink once to prove you're human. This story has everything America loves. Buying stuff, cell phones, and selfies. Happy 4th of July, everyone. But before you head out to stock up for your barbecue tomorrow, make sure you check your price tags carefully. The price of ground beef has been skyrocketing over the past few years. It's up 10% since 2012 to almost $5 a pound. Quartz reports that hamburger is the new steak. On the plus side, though, the price of propane is at a 13-year low. So you can buy your expensive beef, cook it with your cheap propane, and it all evens out in the end. Markets were closed in the U.S. in observance of the 4th of July holiday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. And Kai Rizdahl will be back on Monday. This is APM.